Welcome to Nutrition Conversations, a podcast dedicated to exploring the latest research in nutrition and health in Canada. In each episode, we interview expert guests who break down complex ideas into practical insights. From public health nutrition and chronic disease prevention to the latest in nutrition science, we cover it all. Whether you're a health professional, wellness enthusiast, or just curious about how food shapes our health and well-being, join us as we explore the ever-evolving world of nutrition, one conversation at a time. The views expressed by the guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of CNS. Hosting this episode is Dr. Sharon Panahi, Scientific Director of the Canadian Nutrition Society. She welcomes Dr. Laura Gingagorio to Episode 1 of Season 3 of Nutrition Conversations to discuss the vital role of exercise in supporting mobility, bone health, and muscle strength in older adults.
Hello, Nutrition Conversations listeners. Older adults represent the fastest growing demographic in Canada, with 19% of the population age 65 and older. However, significant gaps in care persist, including limited access to healthcare, the mental health toll of social isolation, and increasing rates of cognitive decline, dementia, and frailty. Addressing these challenges is crucial to supporting healthy aging. As the global population continues to age, understanding the role of diet and physical activity in promoting longevity and quality of life has never been more important. Joining us on this episode is Dr. Laura Gingagorio, who's a professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Health Sciences at the University of Waterloo and Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Bone Health and Exercise Science. She leads the Bone Health and Exercise Science Lab, also known as the Bones Lab. The Bones Lab team leads research on physical activity for older adults and people with osteoporosis. Dr. Gingagorio is a member of the Scientific Advisory Council for Osteoporosis Canada and was on the leadership team that developed the 2020 Canadian 24-hour movement guidelines. She also led the exercise working group for the 2023 Clinical Practice Guidelines for Management of Osteoporosis and Fracture Prevention in Canada. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you, Laura, to Episode 1 of Season 3 of Nutrition Conversations.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm pleased to have you here and talk a little bit about a topic. I mean, we've been touching a lot on nutrition in our podcast, but I'm glad to be talking to you a little bit about other lifestyle factors, including exercise. But before we get into that, maybe we can start a little bit by getting to know more about your journey in this field. So what first sparked your interest in aging, exercise, and bone health?
Yeah, it's a great question. My trajectory was interesting because I started in kinesiology and I actually was really interested in cardiac rehab. And so I did a cardiac rehab practicum and that helped me understand, you know, sort of this relationship between, you know, chronic disease and exercise and how we can improve outcomes, health outcomes in people. And a lot of people in the cardiac rehab space tend to be middle-aged or older adults. So that was sort of how I started to learn about exercise in that age group. And then I went to grad school and I went to grad school to work with, you know, a Canadian leader in cardiac rehab. But it turns out that they had recently got a grant to do a project looking at bone and muscle health in people with spinal cord injury. And so I did my PhD in that area, looking at bone and muscle changes after spinal cord injury and the effects of rehab intervention. So that was kind of my first exposure to sort of the bone health and exercise. And I realized that there was huge gaps when it came to sort of clinical practice and research related to exercise for fracture prevention. So I decided, you know, kind of to continue in that area. And, you know, it really struck me, you know, it's like when you have a heart attack, you get 6 months of cardiac rehab funded by the government. But if you fracture a hip, you might get a few home care visits, right? So it struck me that there are these, you know, huge gaps in terms of what we were doing for exercise and different types of chronic diseases. Even if you have a, you know, if you fracture a vertebra, you get sent home with pain medication. Like there's no rehab like there is for cardiac rehab. So that was sort of how I ended up in the bone health space, is I just identified gaps that I wanted to work on.
Right. And thank you for sharing that. And it seems like your passion for this field has clearly led you to a lot of the impactful work that you're doing, including your recent talk at the a recent CNS 2025 thematic conference that CNS hosted on healthy aging, which was called 80 is the New 50. And I love that title. And one of the key themes of that conference was how exercise plays a vital role in maintaining mobility and overall health as we age. So why is exercise so important as we get older, particularly for bone health, muscle strength, and overall mobility?
Well, you know, when you're, you know, getting out of a chair, you're using, you know, muscle function, right? And so we lose 3 to 8% of our muscle mass per decade after the age of 30. So after a few decades, if you're losing muscle, it starts to feel much more difficult to do things like getting out of a chair because you're working at a higher percent of your muscle's maximum capacity. Because if you have less muscle, you're not as strong. And so these tasks that you used to do easily become harder because it's a higher percent of what your maximum capacity is. And if you look at sort of those changes over time, we see similar changes to balance, cardiovascular fitness, and bone strength. You lose a little bit each year, and you don't feel it, you know, year to year, but you might feel it decade to decade. But many of these things can be, at least to some extent, preventable with certain types of exercise. So certainly you're going to have age-related changes, but the variability in how much someone changes with age is influenced by many of our choices. The choices that we make, you know, in our 40s when it comes to exercise and nutrition can influence the muscle loss or the bone loss that we have during that time. And so those things accumulate. Right. So you want to try to do what you can now to prevent muscle and bone loss. And you start where you're at. So if you're 60, you start and you try to prevent as best you can and maybe even increase muscle a little bit so that you can maintain your physical functioning, your quality of life, your bone strength, your balance as you age.
Of course. And it's not just about exercising in general, but knowing how to move in ways that best support long-term health. And so the 24-hour movement guidelines for adults 65 and older that I mentioned earlier that you were involved in recommend a mix of aerobic activity, muscle strengthening, balance training, adequate sleep, and limiting sedentary time. And I remember this from your presentation at the conference. So can you break down what these guidelines mean in practical terms for older adults?
Yeah, so the first part is the 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity. And that's any kind of activity where you feel like you're working hard and breathing heavier. So that's, I think, a key message. People just think, oh, be physically, be active. And they think, oh, I'm active. But really, that means they're busy and they're moving. But moderate to vigorous is something that feels like it takes effort. So if you think about when you're walking really briskly, or if you're dancing really vigorously, or shoveling, and we've had a lot of snow recently, you know, that would be moderate to vigorous physical activity. So you want to do at least 150 minutes a week, and that's the minimum, right? So more physical activity results in more health benefits, and that translates roughly to about 20 minutes a day of moderate to vigorous physical activity. So you want to do something moderate to vigorous every day for at least 20 minutes, and more physical activity means more health benefits. It also recommends that the guidelines recommend that you sit less and you move around more in general. So breaking up sitting time, so you get up every 30 to 60 minutes, and avoid more than 3 hours of recreational screen time per day. And we have phones now that'll tell us how much recreational screen time we've actually had, so you can use that as a guide. Older adults need to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night and should avoid excessive sleeping, especially during the day. And then the recommendations that often get the least attention in terms of public health messaging, but also in terms of behavior, the things that people do the least in the guidelines are challenging balance exercises. So those can be done every single day, and muscle strengthening exercises, which should be done at least twice a week. So falls are the number one cause of hospitalization in older adults. So doing challenging balance exercises and functional strengthening exercises are the best way to prevent falls. So I do really encourage people to do those and not overlook them. So one of the things that people often say to me when I say go through all these guidelines, like, well, that's a lot, right? And so it's important for people to pick one goal at a time. So, and prioritize, you know, what would be most important for you. So for a person who's at risk of falls, it might actually be better to focus on the balance and strengthening before trying to get out walking every day, especially, you know, in Canada, it's quite icy, right? So maybe better to do the balance and strengthening at home before you go out and risk falling if you have balance impairment, right? So thinking about what is most important for you. And the other thing is, if you're not sleeping well, it's really hard to be physically active if you don't get enough sleep. So for some people, getting enough sleep might be the first goal. So usually encourage people to reflect on what's most important to them and then decide on one thing to start with, rather than trying to do all of the guidelines at once.
Okay. And so what does an ideal day of movement look like for an older adult? Like, is there an ideal day? Or are there specific exercises? I know you've given some examples so far, but and I know there's sort of a focus that you mentioned on, you know, whether it's there's a focus on balance or muscle strength, strengthening, but is there sort of an ideal day?
Yeah, so I mean, it's hard for me to say ideal day because every person is going to be different in terms of what they're capable of, right, and how much time they have, and that sort of thing. But I would say, so starting with the balance and functional exercises, meta-analyses have shown that the interventions that are most effective are those that have a total weekly dose of 3 hours of exercise. They include balance and functional training. That means that they include balance exercises as well as exercises to improve physical functioning, like sit to stands and squats and step ups and those sorts of things. And so those can actually reduce falls by, you know, 42%. So we want to include that at least, you know, 2 to 3 times a week. And then, when it comes to bone health, the types of interventions that are most effective are those that combine impact and resistance training. So, you know, as part of that sort of 2 to 3 times a week, you want to do exercises to improve muscle strength. And then the balance exercises you can do every day. So I like to kind of think about it this way. It's like you want to try to get 20 to 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity each day. And then 2 to 3 times a week, you should incorporate exercises that improve muscle strength and that also improve balance, right? But you can mix it up, right? So if you're doing, exercises like, I'm trying to think of a good example, like an exercise class that gets your heart rate moving but also has balance exercises, then it can count for both, right? Thinking about like the types of exercises you like to do, but also making sure that you're hitting all these different categories, that you're getting, you know, exercise every day, and then on at least 2 to 3 days a week, those exercises include muscle strengthening exercises and balance exercises. And if people want to do other types of things for fun and fitness, they should do it, but they should not replace balance and strength training with other types of. So we see a lot of people who are like, well, I walk and I, dance and I go to this exercise class, but they don't do the balance and the strength training. So I'd say just the only thing I encourage is that you make sure you don't skip that part, because that's really important for preventing muscle loss and maintaining balance. But you can include physical activities that also challenge balance, or, you know, do strength combined with balance training. So for example, like step ups can be used as a strength training exercise, but they also challenge balance. So there are ways to design an exercise program so that you're achieving more than one goal. Does that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. It's great that you're providing these examples. I think that's what our audience would love to hear. And in addition to these general movement guidelines, you've mentioned targeted exercise strategies, definitely crucial for preventing falls, maintaining bone health, especially for individuals at higher risk of osteoporosis. And so you were involved in developing the 2023 Osteoporosis Canada Clinical Practice Guidelines and Fall Prevention Guidelines. So what types of exercises are most effective for maintaining bone health and preventing falls?
For fall prevention, we like to think about balance training. And so there are different types of balance training. So I like to kind of think about sort of four categories. So the first category is exercises that where you often have to shift your body position to stay stable, right? So I mentioned step up. So when you go to do a step up, you lift one foot up to put it on the step. And so you have to automatically shift your weight to the other foot, right? So exercises that require you to do that kind of weight shifting or changing body position to stay stable. The other one is if you're moving around in space and you're becoming unstable, your ability to kind of reestablish that stability. And then movements that bring you to your limits of stability. So if you think about, if you were leaning over, there's going to be a point where you lean a little too far and you become unstable. So finding exercises that kind of challenge you in that way, that bring you to your limits and force you to try to maintain your balance. Another one would be reacting to instability. So having things purposely make you unstable and you have to react. So like some people will do things like stand on a balance board or, play catch whilst, that sort of thing. So things that some of the studies have even done, like pushing people and training them to be able to react accordingly. I wouldn't necessarily recommend you do that. Those are the things. You want to do exercises that require you to adjust your body position, shift your weight, get you to your limits of stability, those sorts of things. So examples would be we do like a one-legged Romanian deadlift where it's like a hinge where you have to bend forward, doing a hip hinge exercise, even things like squats, step ups, like these are all things that move around. I even use the example of polka dancing, right? So if you're at Oktoberfest, you're shifting from one foot to the other and you're spinning around, right? That's a balance challenge. So it's finding ways to challenge your balance. And then in terms of bone health, the types of exercises to try to maintain bone strength are different. They're often exercises that either require a lot of muscle pull on bone or impact to bone. So they're things like higher intensity strength training or hopping and jumping. So high ground reaction forces or hot, strong muscle pull are the types of exercises that seem to be important for maintaining or increasing bone mass.
Right, and preventing fall-related injuries.
I'll separate the fall. So the exercises for fall prevention are things like balance training, right?
Yes.
Where you're trying to improve balance. But for bone strength, you want to, the exercises that seem to be effective are different, right? So that's why you want to combine them.
Okay, perfect. And one of the big questions in this field is the extent to which exercise can increase bone mineral density versus simply slowing down bone loss or improving stability to reduce fracture risk. So would the exercise interventions that you study actually increase bone mineral density, or do they primarily help with maintaining bone strength and preventing falls?
That's a really great question. So I would say that we have high certainty evidence that balance and functional training can prevent falls. So absolutely 100%, if you are doing exercises that challenge balance and improve physical functioning, there is great evidence that it will prevent falls. And that rarely happens in exercise research. We have high certainty evidence, like large, high quality trials that show that it's effective. When it comes to looking at exercise interventions and their effect on bone strength, the quality of evidence is, especially in people at risk of fractures, isn't as good. So we do have some evidence, but it's not as strong. And the changes in bone mineral density are not very large, and they're often more prevention of loss than increasing, although some studies do show a slight increase in bone mineral density. I will say that a lot of times the interventions that seem to show an increase are those that are moderate to high intensity. And so I think that's one of the issues, is that, you'll see, oh yeah, I get out strength training, and they'll say, oh, go do yoga, that's strength training. And it's not. you'll see people with, like, if you Google, older adult strength training, you'll see like people doing bicep curls with 3-pound weights. So the types of interventions that have shown increases are often much higher intensity than the kind of what you see in the media or what you see promoted in kind of the health promotion space. So I guess my answer to your question is that evidence when it comes to bone density is lower certainty. There is some evidence that you can have a positive effect on bone, and it's either going to be a prevention of loss or a small increase in bone mass. But the types of interventions that are effective tend to be moderate to high intensity, either impact or resistance training.
Right.
And often combination, right?
Okay. Right, exactly. And so as we speak of bone health, one question that comes to mind, and we know that men and women experience aging differently, especially when it comes to factors like menopause and its impact on bone density. So would exercise recommendations differ for men and women, particularly considering some of these factors that I've mentioned?
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. And so I will say that there's, when it comes to people with low bone mass and studies in people with low bone mass, there are far fewer studies in men just because men tend to get diagnosed later. They're harder to recruit for these types of studies because they don't often know they have low bone mass. But we do know that although women lose bone earlier in life, 1 in 5 men over the age of 50 will have a fracture due to osteoporosis in their lifetime. And men are more likely to die from hip fracture than women. So we do still need interventions to prevent fractures in men. And I wouldn't say there's any reason why men would need a different type of exercise than women. So if we want to prevent fractures, the best way to do that is to prevent falls. And we do know that there have been men in studies looking at exercise for fall prevention. And so certainly we can apply that same recommendation, doing the balance training for men, and probably would have similar, the exercise resistance and impact training would probably still have a similar effect on low bone mass in men. And there has been one study that showed that they can improve bone mass with resistance and impact training. So I would say the same types of recommendations for both men and women.
Okay. And so while your research primarily focuses on exercise, you're in the Department of Kinesiology, we of course know that nutrition is another key pillar of healthy aging. And so we talk about protein a lot, for example, as an essential for maintaining muscle mass, but we know that many older adults struggle to get enough. And so how do these two factors work together to support mobility and overall health in aging adults?
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, people in the nutrition field maybe need to think carefully about is, you know, you can promote adequate protein intake or increase protein intake, but it's not going to increase muscle mass unless you provide a stimulus to increase muscle mass. So you need to kind of encourage the increased protein intake and strength training concurrently to maximize that potential. So certainly if people aren't getting enough, they could be losing muscle, but in order for them to gain muscle, just giving them a bunch of protein is not necessarily going to solve that problem, right? They need an actual stimulus to increase muscle mass. So we need to encourage people to strength train in addition to increasing protein intake. I'm also of the opinion that the RDA is probably not enough for older adults, especially if they're physically active. So if people are strength training, I encourage them to get 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight per day if they're physically active. They also need to get enough calcium through food and vitamin D and calories. So we encourage them to sort of calculate how much they need in a day and then divide it equally between meals. And I think a lot of people kind of have a light breakfast, but you know, if you're having dinner at 6 o'clock and then you're not eating all night because you're sleeping and then you wake up and you have toast for breakfast, you know, you're probably, you know, when you wake up, you're probably already in muscle protein breakdown because you haven't eaten since, you know, 6 o'clock the day before. So if you don't have a lot of protein at breakfast, then you're probably continuing and you're potentially losing muscle. So I encourage people to get a good bolus of protein, 20 grams of protein at breakfast, just so that they can, you know, get a good start to the day and you know, maximize the potential for muscle protein synthesis. But going back to my earlier point, we're not going to build muscle unless we're actually doing activities to build muscle.
Right. And would this be the same for individuals who are already diagnosed with osteoporosis or sarcopenia?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would encourage all everyone really to make sure they're getting enough protein, and if they're strength training, they probably need more than the RDA, and also that in order to increase muscle or prevent muscle loss, we need to be doing things like strength training, and that starts early. I mean, you start losing muscle in your 40s, right? So should probably be strength training and getting adequate or even more than the RDA if you're strength training of protein.
Exactly. And so despite all the research in this area, we know that there are still many unanswered questions about how to optimize healthy aging through movement and diet. And so from a research perspective, what are some of the biggest gaps in our understanding of how nutrition and exercise work together to support healthy aging?
It's a great question. I think that there's two kind of big areas for me. One is implementation. So we do have lots of research that exercise is effective for fall prevention, that we want to ensure adequate protein and resistance training to prevent sarcopenia, but it's really hard to implement it at scale and implement it in the real world because we don't have, you know, health services that are funded that people can access to learn how to strength train or to, you know, learn how to plan, you know, high protein diet or do balance exercises. So I think, you know, thinking about how we can do effective implementation is one. And the second is the idea that, you know, people often become dissatisfied with the changes that occur to their body with aging, and or they're encouraged to lose weight for health reasons, right? And so they restrict calories to lose weight, and sometimes inconsistently. So you have this, you know, kind of weight cycling that may happen. But they don't know that when you're losing weight, you're also losing bone, right? And losing muscle, which may not actually be advantageous. So I actually don't like that kind of messaging of, you know, weight loss for health. Is I think really what we want to do is encourage adequate protein and nutrients, and then encourage strength training and aerobic training for fitness, so that we're building a healthy physique and healthy habits rather than dieting. And that will also help people get stronger and healthier. And I think that kind of messaging and research kind of encouraging that, as opposed to diets for weight loss, is something that we need to, it's a shift that we need.
Right. And speaking of messaging, we often hear the message, be physically active. But what can clinicians, researchers, and even family members do to better support older adults in maintaining their mobility and strength?
Yeah, I am. I'm maybe in the minority, but I'm not a big fan of the whole move more messaging. I believe that a generic message, it might be more appealing to people because it's easier. But this generic message to be more physically active doesn't necessarily translate to people getting enough physical activity, and particularly getting people to do balance training, strength training, the types of things that are more considered exercise that require a plan, right? A lot of people think they're physically active, but we know from public health surveillance that most people are not meeting physical activity guidelines, right? In order for you to actually do the things that align with the guidelines, you need to make concrete plans, because you have to plan every day to get your moderate to vigorous, or do your strength training twice a week, do your balance challenges. You don't have a plan, you're not likely to do it. So we need to encourage people to make a plan to exercise, and also to have backup plans, so that if you change your plans, you know, when you're not feeling it, that you have an alternative. So you do it on Saturday instead of Thursday. And also to progressively increase the challenge of the physical activity that you're doing if you want to get stronger or better. So if you are trying to get stronger, you might start with bodyweight squats, but you do need to make it harder over time. You need to add weight or change the way you do your squats to make it harder if you want to get stronger. Otherwise, you're going to, if you do the same thing all the time, you're going to stay the same level of fitness.
Right. And I kind of want to shift gears a little bit, not too much, but you and I chatted a little bit about some of the work that you do when we were at the conference in terms of knowledge translation, which seems to also be a key aspect of your work. So turning research into practical advice that people can apply in their daily lives, and making research accessible and actionable for the public, clinicians, and policymakers. So how do you approach this, and what strategies have been most effective in translating your findings into sort of this real world impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, one of the things we do is we work with Osteoporosis Canada to design education tools and resources for patients and for healthcare providers. And I think that, you know, because they have a national platform, right? So they can, and we've heard from healthcare professionals that it really helps when you have, you know, sort of that stamp from a recognized organization. So the idea that you have this, you know, recognized organization that is putting out information that people can trust. So that's, I think, one thing is thinking about trust. There's a lot of misinformation out there, so people are really looking for trustworthy sources of information. So working with organizations that are perceived as trustworthy to design education tools. So we do that. We do webinars and other communication strategies with them. I also kind of work with people who train healthcare and exercise professionals and share the latest research with them so that it's built into training programs. We're starting to dabble in social media, so our Bones Lab has a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. We also have a mailing list where we send out research and information directly to people. So I think that it's, you know, figuring out where your audience is and where they get information and what kind of information they trust or what types of messages resonate with them, and then designing your tools accordingly. And you may have to do multiple things. So right now, for example, we're working with, you know, the folks that do the e-referral platforms in Ontario and trying to figure out a way to support e-referral to community fall prevention programs and to actually make it easy for physicians to use so that they can refer people. So it's like thinking about, okay, how do I make it easier for physicians to recommend it so that people will actually do it, or to facilitate access to programs that exist and help people know where they are. So you have to kind of identify what are the barriers and what are the bottlenecks, and what is the information that people are looking for, and then how do you reach those audiences and in an effective way. I think that's kind of the crux of it.
Right. And I know you have a lot of resources, and you mentioned a YouTube channel, and I think you had mentioned some videos earlier. So just for our listeners, you know, if they were to follow you on social media, is there a sort of a platform they can follow? I know you mentioned that the Bones Lab, and I know there are some great short videos, I believe. I've watched a couple of them myself, and I think they're fantastic. Would it be the Bones Lab? Would it be?
So there's Bones Lab on YouTube. So it's just Bones Lab, all one word. And then our Facebook page is UW Bones Lab. And so we've used mainly those. I also have a Twitter, but that's mostly academic stuff. But I do post some of our stuff there as well. And then, Osteoporosis Canada's website has information as well. We've done some videos with them. We've done a one pager actually that is just talks about like the types of exercise that we recommend for people to do and gives them some examples. And it's available in English, French, Punjabi, Spanish, and Chinese, I believe. And it's freely downloadable so that folks can go to Osteoporosis Canada's website under exercise and they can find it there. And we have a booklet that's a bit more comprehensive and has a lot more ideas that's coming out pretty soon as well.
Okay, that's great. So it's clear that exercise, we talked more about that than the nutrition aspect, but both are powerful tools for aging well. And your work in the area of exercise is certainly helping to bridge the gap between science and practical application. And your insights have certainly provided a clear picture of what it takes to stay active and independent as we age. So thank you so much, Laura, for sharing your expertise and for the incredible work that you do in making research accessible and actionable. And your contributions are helping to shape how we approach aging, not just as a challenge, but as an opportunity to thrive. So thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you for tuning in to Nutrition Conversations. We hope that you found today's discussion informative and inspiring. If you're interested in hearing more about the latest research in nutrition and health, be sure to check out our website at cns-scn.ca/podcast for upcoming podcasts. Remember, our podcasts are always available on the Spotify app, so you can easily listen to us on the go. Simply search for the Nutrition Conversations podcast on Spotify and you'll find all our episodes in one place. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode.